See, even unplugged, there's no sound. Yeah, I guess I'm going to have to narrate it. That's too bad. I'm much better than these guys anyways. So the point of this skit, which is so unfortunate because it is good, is that, to set it up, is that they decided that they would not stop working. And the one guy, Dwight, is amazing to him because he's kept working the entire time to the point where he's peeing in a bottle rather than going to the bathroom. On the other hand, this character, Jim is his name, says that he doesn't understand how he can do that. He can't imagine that he could keep working that long. In fact, he's exhausted from just watching him, and he's probably going to just have to quit work and go home for the day because he's so tired from that, which basically captures my idea in a nutshell in a couple ways. For one thing, the expression, the idea that watching this guy monitoring him is so exhausting that he can't keep forcing himself to keep working. That's the basic idea of depletion. But the other thing that's interesting is why is that he is depleted? Why is he can't keep going? Why can't he force himself to continue work? Whereas the other guy can keep peeing in the bottle and keep working throughout the day. And it works so much better when I don't have to narrate it. Basically, this leads to the idea I have of self-control strength. The idea behind self-control strength is that we only have a limited capacity or resource for exerting self-control. That overriding or changing a behavior, anytime we stop, inhibit, change a behavior, a mood, a thought, prevent ourselves from acting in some way, it requires a resource. And I've called this resource self-control strength. We can call it whatever we want, but I call it self-control strength. This self-control strength is finite. We only have a certain amount of this strength. And our self-control strength, our self-control performance is related to that level of resource. People who have more resource do better at self-control. And the final point is that resources are expended in the process of exerting self-control, that we deplete these resources by exerting self-control. And so therefore, after exerting self-control, subsequent attempts at self-control are less likely to succeed. We've depleted that resource, we're less able to exert self-control, and therefore it's more likely to fail. And so this is a fairly simple idea, but it suggests that our self-control is bounded, that we don't have infinite resources for exerting self-control. This is for the more graphically minded, we can look at it this way. That my laser pointer usually doesn't work. Oh, good, we can see it. So self-control leads to exerting self-control leads to a loss of self-control strength, which leads to poor self-control performance subsequently. So what I'm gonna do is, like I said, I'm gonna try to show you a little bit of empirical data about this, and then go and talk a little bit about some implications of this and trying to understand some other ideas that spring from this in terms of motivation. So this is a talk on addictions. So I was going to talk a little about the role of self-control in addictions. The design of these studies I'm an experimentalist. The design of these studies is fairly straightforward in that we assign people to either exert self-control or not exert self-control. Then somewhere between 2 and 10 minutes later, we have them do a task that requires self-control. And we compare performance to people who work on a task that's perhaps not pleasant, perhaps is just as physically demanding, but doesn't require them to overcome or override a strong impulse. So in the first study, about alcohol, what we did is I took people from the Albany area, advertised in a local paper, and said we just wanted people who like to drink, just advertise for drinkers. Had them come in and randomly assign them to, this is actually within subjects, to either sniff alcohol or sniff water in counterbalanced order. So first they sniffed alcohol and then they sniffed water or vice versa. Between each task, what they had to do was they had to squeeze a hand grip, and I should have brought one with me, a little hand exerciser. It's something if you want to build up your strength or something like that. You can always hold these hand exercises for 1 second longer if you exert self-control. If you override your impulse to release, you overcome pain, the fatigue in your hand, you can hold it for 1 second longer, but that requires a good deal of self-control. It requires a great deal of inhibition. The other task I had them do was something called a stop signal test. It's a much more cognitive task in that boxes appear on the screen on the left or right side, and you have to indicate by pressing a key if it's what side it's on. And on a quarter of the trials, a tone sounds. And when the tone sounds, you have to stop yourself from responding. So you're getting a pretty good clip. It's pretty easy. It's pretty automatic to left, right, left, right, left. And then all of a sudden, the tone sounds, you have to stop yourself from doing what's sort of become a habit, if you will. And so this is all within subjects. I compared the performance on these two dependent measures to the performance after sniffing the alcohol and after sniffing water. So what would happen is they'd have a glass of their preferred beverage, usually beer. They'd pick it up, they'd sniff it, they'd put it in front of their face. They were told to visualize, imagine how it tastes, and then put it down. They did this for 5 minutes. In the water condition, same thing, only it was just bottle. It was a tap water. Assuming that most people have a stronger urge to drink alcohol than they do to drink water. These people, we didn't dehydrate them or anything like that. So the alcohol tends to be more tempting to drink than the water. So what I want to show here is that this is the hand grip time. Oh, I can use my laser pointer. So after sniffing the alcohol, they release the hand grip much sooner than after sniffing the water. It's a difference of about 5 seconds. That's a significant difference, even though I don't believe in error bars. So performance on one task suffers after exerting self-control on other unrelated tasks. The same thing was found on the stop signal. This is the performance on the no tone trials, how many times they correctly sorted the boxes. You can see that they did it. There's no difference there. And there's different, the stop signal onset time is different. It's really not terribly important because it doesn't really affect anything. There's no interaction across onset times or anything like that. There's just a main effect that after sniffing alcohol, they were less able to stop themselves. When the tone sound, they're more likely to respond there than after sniffing water. The other thing I looked at was how tempted they were by the water or the alcohol. And once again, this illustrates the main effect here. You can see that this is pooled across all the different stop signal times. That there's a main effect, so after sniffing alcohol, they perform more poorly than after sniffing water. But there's also an interaction here, so that people who are highly tempted to drink the alcohol had more failures, were less able to exert themselves than people who are high in temptation, who are low in temptation, rather. The water didn't work so well, probably because the water wasn't terribly tempting in either condition. It was a scale, modified. It's a
self-report.
Self-report. Flipping this around now to show another study. This one is actually a consumption study. This one they actually had to resist the temptation to drink. So that one was resisting the temptation to drink, how that affects subsequent behavior. This is how exerting self-control initially affects subsequent ability to resist temptation. So I advertised again in the local paper for people who wanted to drink. As you can imagine, we had people lined up out the door when they found out that they were going to be paid $25 and all the beer they could drink in 20 minutes. This is quite a popular study. You'd be amazed at how much beer people could drink in 20 minutes. Or maybe not. Maybe you wouldn't be surprised, but I was surprised at how much that people could drink in 20 minutes. The worst part about that study is then I had to babysit them until they sobered up. The review board made me sit there with them, and so there's nothing you can do. You just sit there for hours and hours trying to entertain drunk people. One drunk person. It's painful, painful. Okay, so the initial task, when they first came in, I had them either exert self-control by trying to suppress a thought, put the thought of a white bear out of your head. People have used this to experimentally study thought control, obsessive thought, for a while now. It's a very difficult task to do. If you're trying to do that now, you'd find out that the thought keeps popping into your head. So it takes a fair bit of self-control to try to put the thought of a white bear out of your head. People in the no self-control tradition solve math problems. They were addition problems. People find doing addition unpleasant, frustrating. They didn't have to, like, it takes some self-control to do this. I know self-control is probably a misnomer. It's probably less self-control. It's just not as cool to put that on your slide. So I just call it no self-control, but it's less self-control. It's not like you have to overcome a strong impulse of suppressing a thought. And then independent measure, and then after they did this for a few minutes, I put a couple pitchers of beer in front of them and told them to drink as much as they wanted. Told them they had to drink some, but they could stop after drinking just a sip or two. I told them, however, that after they drank, they were going to take a driving simulator test. And if they did well in this driving test, they'd win a prize. Sort of like a designated. So they're put in a difficult position where they want to drink free beer. Hey, great. But they also want to win the prize. So they're put in a position where they should want to try to restrain themselves, where they're motivated to try to cut back on how much they drink. And so we're curious to see how much self-control they actually exert, whether they succeed in limiting their alcohol intake. And so this is the amount consumed in 20 minutes. And so depleted participants drank about 750 milliliters as compared to the non-depleted participants, drank about 100 milliliters more, which if my metric systems runs correctly, which is about a third of a beer, a third of a bottle. So they drank about a third of a bottle more. And as measured by their blood alcohol content, they were considerably higher. Their average was about 5.5 as opposed to 4.0. Basically, about in New York anyways, where this was done, about two-thirds of these people would have been pulled over for driving with ability impaired, as opposed to under half of these people. So after exerting self-control, their ability to regulate their alcohol intake suffered. They were less able to control themselves. Before I go on, I should talk that I didn't measure other extraneous variables that could be influencing this. For example, people in the depletion condition reported that they were in the same mood as people in the no depletion condition. They reported that they were just as aroused. They reported they were just as frustrated. They reported it was just as unpleasant to solve the math problems as it was to try to suppress their thoughts. The only difference was people in the depletion condition say they reported that they reported exerting a lot more self-control than people in the no depletion condition. People who suppressed their thoughts reported took more self-control than solving math problems. I want to just move it out. One more study before I move on to some other deeper issues. Move this out to the real world a little bit. This was done with 106 underage drinkers who carry palm top computers, little PDAs, and reported on their drinking and their self-control demands, among other variables, as they went about their lives. They carried these palm top computers for 3 weeks. They were trained to interact with them whenever they drank, and they also answered questions at various times during the day, when they woke up, at bedtime, right after dinner. So we could assess a lot and measure their moods, measure their urges, measure their behaviors all throughout the day, and track how the time course of these things fall apart. Particularly what I was interested in was two things. First of all, I was interested in their self-control demands. In other words, how depleted they felt. So every evening, around 6 o'clock or so, they answered 4 questions about their self-control demands. Are you dealing with stress? Are you dealing with negative emotions? Are you controlling unwanted thoughts? Is there too much going on in your life? This is just a basic measure of how much self-control they exerted that day. Then, At that same time, they also answered their intentions to drink that evening. How much do you intend to drink? Do you intend to drink it all tonight? Whenever they sat down to start drinking, they pulled out this PDA and answered questions about their urge to drink, their mood, their arousal. And people were fairly good about this when we asked them later on, did you miss any drinking episodes? How long did it take you from the start of drinking to actually enter this information? People said that they're fairly accurate, that they missed very few episodes, and they usually got it start entering the data within moments after sitting down and start drinking. After drinking, they indicated the amount they consumed. And most critically for my interest is whether or not they reported whether or not they drank more than they intended. This is all self-reported, but did you drink more than you intended? Did you violate your self-imposed drinking limit? The results, I don't need to go too much detail about perhaps underlying statistics, but its results were analyzed using hierarchical linear modeling. Basically, what this is massively within subjects. Every person acts as their own control, so that I can tell that what we're doing here is comparing to each person's average. So on days that participants report more self-control demands than their average, they're more likely to drink, consume more if they did drink, become intoxicated, and most critically, violate their self-imposed drinking limits. They drank more than they intended. They lost control over their alcohol intake on days when they poured more self-control demands than average. Of course, the problem with this sort of non-experimental correlational data is that there's a lot of things that could be going on. Let me try to convince you that what's going on here is it's being driven by this ego depletion effect rather than some other effect. First of all, the relationship between self-control demands and limit violations held when I controlled for urge before drinking or mood. So it's not that it's just if you had a stressful day, it makes you want to drink more or put you in a bad mood. Once we control for those things, this relationship still exists. We still find a link between self-control demands and lost control over drinking. There are no intentions between self-control demands and intentions to drink or plans to limit drinking. It's not that you say, I had a bad day, and so to hell with it, I'm just going to go out tonight and go crazy. Or I'm not going to bother limiting myself. No, that's not the case either. It seems to be that it's not working through intent by changing intentions or plans or anything like that. The final point, I think, is the most interesting, at least in my mind. We asked people if they plan to limit their intake. Do you plan to limit your intake? We asked them this at the start of every drinking episode. Well, if you don't plan to limit your intake, you're not exerting self-control. You're just going to go out and drink until you don't feel like drinking anymore. So you have no intentions to control yourself, and therefore you're not exerting self-control, and it means that this depletion effect shouldn't affect you. It shouldn't matter to you. Only if you're going to limit yourself does self-control matter. Does the fact that your resources have been depleted matter? So this is shown at plus and one minus standard deviation on that variable. So running across the bottom, we have self-control demands. Increasing self-control demands, and this is the amount of alcohol consumed. As you can see, I hope you can see at least in the back, is this gold bar represents the people who don't plan to limit. These are people who are not exerting self-control. They're just going to go out and have a good time and drink until they don't feel like drinking anymore. And you can see this is a flat line pretty much. There's no relationship there. Self-control, the number of self-control demands wasn't amount related to how much they were planning to drink or how much they actually drank. So in other words, being depleted had no effect on these people who weren't exerting self-control, which is what the model would predict. On the other hand, this sort of, we'll call it gray, this gray bar has a nice linear effect here that as the self-control demands go up, these people drank more. The people who planned to limit were more affected by self-control demands. When they had more self-control demands, they're more affected by it led to poor regulation of alcohol intake. They lost control more. So I guess the point I'm trying to get with these studies is that our ability to exert self-control seems to be bounded, that we don't have an unlimited capacity to exert self-control. Instead, it takes some personal resource. Someone in my lab by the name of Matt Gallant, he's been doing research on glucose. And I don't have any slides because it's his research and I don't want to talk about it, take away from his research. But he's basically shown that if you measure people's blood glucose levels after exerting self-control, it goes down. That if you give people a drink of orange juice, we can sort of negate this whole depletion effect. So he's argued that basically this resource that I'm talking about in a sort of abstract sense may be glucose levels in the brain. Obviously, there's no way to really test this. I have a colleague at Albany who does research, similar research on cognitive functioning in rats. I envy him because he actually studies glucose as well, but he can kill the rats, dissect the brains, and measure the actual levels of glucose. There's a couple students I'd like to do that to, but unfortunately, the IRB is not letting me kill students and measure the glucose levels after exerting self-control. Okay, so let me talk about one additional study because I think this leads into another area that I want to talk about. So as I said in the introduction, research has shown, and it's been argued from a theory called the general theory of crime, that self-control is critical to criminal behavior, that criminals have low self-control. Not terribly shocking, I suppose, if you think about it. So I wanted to test this out with my undergrads. And so I set up a situation where they could cheat, basically. I gave them a set of logic problems that were fairly difficult to solve. And in fact, they were beyond fairly difficult because I modified them so there was no correct answers. It's not obvious at first glance that there's no correct answers. It's sort of hard to tell that. But it was, they made it very difficult. They obviously couldn't solve them. I told them, though, that the problems were, if the answer would be obvious to them, and they would just tell me if they got the question right or not. So there was no need, I wasn't going to verify them. They could just tell me if they got the answer right. And so I was, obviously, if they say they got the answer right, they're in some way deceiving me or deceiving themselves. So there was a couple of things going on before they did that, however. First of all, I had them exert self-control. In this study, they exerted self-control by either, I had them type a paragraph into the computer, and they were told to avoid typing the E. As they retype this paragraph into the computer, they shouldn't hit the E button. And again, for most people, typing is a fairly automatic task, something we do unconsciously, so it takes a lot of effort to not hit the E key. People in no self-control condition just type the paragraph as they saw it. This doesn't take much self-control. In the high motivation group, I told them that they would have to turn in their papers, that actually I sort of misspoke, that I was going to verify their answers by having them turn in their papers. The low motivation group were told that they could just throw away the papers. In fact, I had a shredder there, they could drop it into the shredder. And so the only record of how many questions they got right or wrong would be their own response to me. And so what I was interested in is how many problems they actually solved. So this is the percent of people who said they solved at least one problem correctly. So you can look here in this no depletion condition that about a third of the people said they solved problems when they didn't. You could think of that as the baseline for lying in UAlbany students. If you're ungenerous, if you're generous, you could think of this as the baseline for deceiving yourself, thinking you did something, thinking you got a problem right when you didn't actually. If you're generous, it doesn't really matter. It's just a baseline. And as you can see, the depleted participants who kept their paper were considerably higher than everyone else. These people were much more likely to say they solved a problem when they didn't, much more than this baseline level, which suggests that they are probably lying to me, that they probably are somehow deceiving me, lying, cheating in some way. So that, once again, replicates this basic depletion effect. But what I want to focus your attention on is this cell right here. This cell is a lot more interesting in my mind, because these people were also depleted, but you can see that they didn't do any different than the no depletion condition. When the paper is being turned in, when there's going to be a check on their accuracy, they were just as honest or dishonest, as you want to perceive it, as the non-depleted people. In other words, these people were able to overcome their depletion. They were able to be honest. They were able to exert self-control if they thought the odds of being caught were too great, if the risk of being caught were too great. Which led me into wondering about the role of motivation and self-control. That it seemed like this depletion is probably not the end all of all self-control. That it can't explain, at least in laboratory situations, why self-control fails. People who come into my laboratory to do these studies of squeezing a hand grip, typing paragraphs, it's not like at the end of the study they take off their clothes. It's not like they urinate in the corner. It's not like when they're frustrated with me, they take a swing at me. That's never happened in, 20 years of doing these studies. So obviously they're not losing all control. They're not a puddle on the floor, unable to walk out the door. So there's something going on here that it's not that they're unable to exert self-control. Instead, there's some other deeper process happening here. So just to illustrate this, perhaps, let me show you another study I did, because it's kind of fun, looking at motivation and depletion. So this particular study, I paid people, I had a cold, and I decided to try some of this liquid cold medicine. It was awful, could barely choke it down, and I thought, that'd be a kind of cool measure of self-control. So I made some Kool-Aid. I don't know if people in Britain know what Kool-Aid is. It's just a powdered drink mix. You're supposed to add sugar to it. I've originally tried to make it without sugar, and it tasted pretty bad. It tastes pretty bad with sugar, but it tastes bad without sugar too. But people were still able to tolerate it and drink it, so I had to doctor it up a little more. I poured some vinegar into it. And now vinegar-laced Kool-Aid is some nasty, nasty stuff. Took the finish right off the table. It is possible, however, to, through self-control, to force yourself to drink this, to overcome the urge not to drink it and drink this bad-tasting Kool-Aid. So I was interested in how many cups of this they would drink. To help them along, I either paid them a penny for every ounce or a quarter for every ounce. Penny is not very good motivation. Quarter is much better motivation, obviously. And then before they actually did the drinking, I had them do some self-control activities. I had them watch, it's actually a very funny video, Robin Williams stand-up. I've seen it hundreds of times. It's hysterical. I still find it funny. People in the no self-control condition were told to regulate their emotions, to try not to laugh, try not to smile, keep a straight face while watching it. This is a very difficult exercise. There used to be a game show years ago where people had to do this. And despite, chance to win lots and lots of money, people found it very difficult not to laugh. People in no self-control condition just watched the movie normally, didn't laugh. They could laugh if they wanted to. They didn't have to laugh. And so, like I said, what I was interested in is how this influenced the amount of Kool-Aid they actually drank. Once again, my dislike for error bars makes this a little hard to interpret sometimes. But this bar, the depletion high pay, is no different than these two bars. These three bars are all within error limits of each other. The only cell that differed was this one. Depleted people in the low pay condition drank far less Kool-Aid than everyone else. Depleted people who were paid well drank the same amount, even though it looks higher, it's actually the same amount as people in the no depletion condition. People can overcome depletion if sufficiently motivated. If given a good reason, we can overcome depletion. Which makes sense again, because obviously people are not a puddle on the floor in my laboratory room. They can walk out the door. They're not making sexual advances at me. They're not swinging at me. They're not going to, and it's good to know that they're not going to go out and go binge drink or anything like that. What probably comes down to is that, frankly, they don't really care about my studies. My laboratory studies are unimportant to them, and so unless they really push them, they're not going to try. which led to the whole idea which I've come to, which is the idea of conservation. The reason why we find these depletion effects isn't that we're totally out of resources, that we have no resources available at all. But what happens is that we've decided that the resources are too valuable to spend, that we're motivated to conserve resources, and therefore we're not going to exert self-control in this particular setting. To use a muscle metaphor, all this actually comes down to a muscle metaphor, but to use a muscle metaphor, you know, if you're expecting to go home, if you're expecting a long run, you might take it easy the day before so you have energy for that run. You might take it easy during that day so you have the energy for a long run later that day. Or if you're running if you're doing a boxer, perhaps, well, take it easy in the first couple of rounds so they have energy to keep fighting at the end of the round. You have to pace yourself. And that's basically the idea here, is that we're trying to pace ourselves. We're trying to conserve our energy for what really matters and don't spend it on places where it doesn't matter. So I tested these ideas by basically giving people incentives to care about the future or not. The idea is that if you're expecting some future demand that's going to take a lot of self-control resources, you're going to save your energy. You're going to save your energy and therefore perform more poorly on current activities. On the other hand, if you think that the future is going to be very easy, it's not going to take a lot of self-control, you may be more free spending. You may feel like it's okay, I can spend this energy because I'll have a chance to recover it in the future. So in this particular study, we depleted people by having them suppress their thoughts or solve math problems, just like I've done one other study I've talked about. I started running out of original ideas and started replicating my own ways of measuring self-control. I told people that after they did this thought suppression or solving math problems, they're going to do two more tasks. The next task was going to be a cold press where they had to hold their hand in ice water. And then after that, they're going to watch a movie. And in one condition, I told them that they're going to watch the movie normally, no special instructions, just like in the previous study I just talked about where it didn't require self-control. People in the other condition, I told them that they're going to have to regulate their emotions. That's a very funny video. They're going to have to prevent themselves from laughing, that this would take self-control. So people in this condition expected to exert self-control in the future. People in this condition did not. And then I actually had them put their hand in the bucket of ice water and saw how long they held it in there for. Again, you know, tolerating physical pain, persisting when you might rather quit. This takes a lot of self-control. So we'd expect that people who are willing to expend self-control should hold their hand in the ice water longer than people who are trying to conserve. And so the first thing is, in the no depletion condition, there's not really anything going on here. They held their hand in ice water about the same regardless of the future task. Apparently we need to have a certain level of depletion to potentiate this effect. But that if we don't have any depletion, we're not really concerned about it. We feel we have enough resources, so we're not caring. If we're depleted though, the future task matters. If we think the future task is going to take self-control, participants took their hand out of the ice water much sooner than if they think the future task does not require self-control. This suggests again that people are trying to conserve, that they're trying to save their energy for future tasks. And the reason why self-control fails isn't because we're totally out of energy, but because we've decided that it's gotten too much. It's going to take too much effort, too much energy. One more study, just to show this again, perhaps in another way. In this case, we told them that we depleted them by either the typing task, typing no E's, or typing anything they wanted. They were told in the future they would solve math problems, or that they were going to, which doesn't take a lot of self-control, or that they're going to have to regulate their attention, control their thoughts. This takes a lot of self-control. And then the dependent measure in this case was a test of concentration. You have to watch the computer screen while numbers flash on the screen. You have to hit the space bar when you hit a 6 followed by a 4. And it's a very difficult task, goes on for 15, 20 minutes, bores the hell out of people. And so it takes a lot of self-control to prevent yourself from letting your mind wander, as I'm sure you all are aware right now. That's a joke. So again, the no depletion condition, not much going on there. Where's my laser? We need the depletion effect to potentiate this. On the other hand, when we're depleted, when we think this future task is going to take self-control, people did a lot worse on this vigilance test. They were much poorer at regulating their attention compared to people who did not expect to exert self-control in the future. Okay, let's see what else I want to say. I could keep going on, you know. I could talk about the idea of building strength. I have some really nice data that's coming out showing that we can actually get better at self-control. Someone asked this question the other day, and I sort of hedged. I said, I don't want to steal from my thunder, but I actually didn't put the slides in my talk. But there's some interesting research that suggests we can get better at self-control through practice, that just like a muscle, and we're talking here, that muscle gets fatigued. You know, you lift a bunch of weights, your muscle's fatigued, not going to be able to lift as much subsequently. Well, you go home, you have a night's rest, you eat well, your muscle gets stronger. Same thing seems to work for self-control, that if you exert a lot of self-control, if you practice small acts, you're going to get better at it. I've shown that people are more successful at quitting smoking if they practice self-control before that. So I'll be happy to talk about it if anyone wants, but I think I'll just move on here. So the conclusion, and this is where perhaps I'm hoping that people can help me out here a little. People treat self-control as if it's a limited resource. They seem to think that self-control is a limited resource, the fixed quantity, that gets depleted through exertion. That after exerting self-control, we think that it depletes some of this resource, and therefore we feel weaker. Moreover, the reason why we fail at self-control is because we think that we need to save energy for the future. That we're concerned that if we exert self-control now, we may not have the energy we need for future self-control demands. So it's not that self-control becomes impossible. It may be that at some point self-control becomes impossible, but I can't imagine many circumstances where that happens. And much like muscle fatigue, at some point you may cramp and be unable to lift that weight, but usually we quit working well before we reach the point where our muscles so fatigued we're unable to even pick up anything. So what this suggests is that people exert if motivated, people can overcome self-depletion. They're willing to exert self-control sufficiently motivated, which suggests that this self-control is psychologically mediated, that our beliefs about self-control, that our thoughts, our desires really play an important role determining whether or not self-control is going to succeed. The final point is where I get onto the thinnest ice, which is that I think what the process going on here is something that I like to call mitigated acquiescence. The idea is that depletion doesn't lead to self-control failure directly. It's not that we've reached the point where we just can't exert self-control anymore. Instead, what it does is it sets up the conditions where we feel like it's okay to allow ourselves not to continue. That as self-control gets harder, as it feels more effortful, we may think that, you know what, it's just not worth it anymore. I'm going to save my resources. And so this provides a sort of a ready excuse to allow ourselves to fail that self-control. And if motivated, under most circumstances, we could probably overcome this acquiescence and allow ourselves to push ourselves forward and actually succeed at the self-control task. So I guess in the end, we all have to be careful in how we exert self-control. So when we go out there for coffee after this and there's that cake, you might want to take that cake just so you have energy for the rest of the day. Thank you very much.
Okay, I want to thank Mark and thank the organizers for inviting me. So as Walter said yesterday, I'm the only thing between you and the speaker, so I'm just going to say, make a few brief remarks. I just have four slides that I'll use quickly. And some of them will just try to be helpful to the general conversation we've been having about addiction. So this is a, so one of the things we've been talking about at this conference is, or it seems to me one of the topics that's been out there is, what's the relationship between different levels or styles of explanation? So we've been talking about the folk psychological level of explanation, or the refined folk psychological level of explanation, about psychological data and psychological findings, and then neurobiological findings. This is a one way that I've recommended in the past about thinking about problems in, well, this was specifically something that called the natural method, which I proposed, I think, in 1991. Patty Churchland had proposed something like it earlier in her book on neurophilosophy. Many people didn't notice this, but at the time, I think because Patty was so identified with eliminativism about the folk psychological level, but really she suggested even in that book that in order to ever get to a full theory of mind, we would have to at least start with the ordinary concepts that we had, and then that is of belief and desire, hope, expectations, willpower, attention, that these terms were part of the ordinary ways we had of speaking. But that eventually, as we looked for how to map those to lower levels, we would see that the top level descriptions were, as it were, under-motivated, they had long, long histories that weren't tied to scientific traditions, and so on and so forth. So that was, Patty put that forward as a hypothesis about how the looking at these different levels would work out. What I did in my own work on consciousness, and this is from this particular picture, I think, is from a journal of philosophy paper I wrote on dreams. But earlier, I had proposed that this was a method that was most commonly used to understand consciousness or understand mental states in general. And the idea here was just that we start with phenomenology. We start with descriptions about how things seem to the agent. And I was interested, I can't go into it now, but I was making a distinction in those days, and I still like to do this, between phenomenology considered as reports about how things seem to the agent, as opposed to introspection, which I understand is something stronger, like this is the phenomenology would tell you, this is the state I'm in, like I'm having a dream, and the dream seems in technicolor. That's a phenomenological report. If you say something like, the dream means such and so, you have a theory of dream interpretation, that's going way beyond how it seems. That's invoking usually a theory, a psychological theory, for example, a Jungian or Freudian theory about dream interpretation, which comes from a different level. Some people will claim to introspect that the meaning of a dream is such and so, and I think that's just preposterous. So there are rules about phenomenology. It's kind of a thick description, but it's thin in the sense that one wouldn't make inferences about the causes of the states one's in. Now, the reason this is relevant to what we're talking about at this conference and to what so Mark was talking about today, so we might get phenomenological descriptions from people in ordinary language about how effortful controlling themselves, especially in the face of things that they like a lot, Walter and cake. They might report that this is really difficult, and other people might just say, I just don't notice the cake. I'm just not a cake person. Okay, this would be a phenomenological report. We would then like to know sort of what's going on in the system. In the case of cake desires, it wouldn't be neurobiological probably. It would be more, we'd look in other parts of the body perhaps. But I take it what Mark is doing here today with things like discussions of people who have strong desires to drink, who show up to get have beer in Albany, so these people know something about themselves. They're willing to report it. I'm the kind of person who likes beer, and I'm willing to get paid money for it. And then they go there, and he studies at the psychological level how these people are, as it were, doing on these tests that involve self-control when they're given sniffs of water versus sniffs of what they really came there for, beer. Okay, and we watch that at the psychological level. Nothing is said about what's going on neurobiologically. We bring in someone like Kent maybe to tell us about that story, or Steve Hyman. I take it just also to relate this to, so I think that George Ainslie's a very important work, we would say, is at the psychological level. George knows stories that he would tell at the next level, or he knows people who will tell the neurobiological story, but hyperbolic discounting is, we might say, a description or an explanation. And that's an important distinction. Some people would want to say, well, and I think Patty and I are both inclined to say this, these levels are more descriptive. If you want really the real bang for your buck, you're going to have to go down to the lowest level to get the story of the mechanisms. Okay, but that's, I don't think that is relevant to what I'll now go on to say. But at this point, in suggesting the natural method, my claim was something like this, and I still believe this. Take all these data sources, take the phenomenological, take important psychological research like this, and then get the neuroscientific data and see how it all looks together. At first, there'll be no trump rules. That is, it isn't automatic that the phenomenology will trump the neuroscience. Usually, I'd say the trumps will go down for the lower levels to the top levels. But at least at this point in time, I just say, leave it open. Just see how the story unfolds, because we know so little about how the system works. So that's number one. So what about the phenomenology? This is something that I just feel the need to say, that one of the concerns, because I've identified myself as a person who's an addict here, is, I think, we haven't been careful enough at this conference, and this has nothing to do with Mark's talk, because he wasn't talking specifically about it, addiction. But to bring it back there, if one were to start with the phenomenology, but also with knowing something about the neuroscience, I think we'd say something like this, that phenomenologically, every addict knows this, especially addicts who have cross addictions, that there's different kinds of addictions, and we should superscript them. They're actually superscripted to different molecules, so ethanol. All alcoholics know, for example, they're all addicted to exactly the same molecule. They have not lots of knowledge about how to get doses quickly or slowly, right? The difference between beer and vodka, or you know, so on and so forth. Other addicts will, and every addict has a drug of choice in relation to which he or she has to exert lots of self-control if he or she doesn't want to use that particular drug. And different drugs cause, for addicts, different problems of self-control. Many people who are addicted to alcohol can take or leave pot. Some people who are opiate addicts could take or leave alcohol. Usually, if you're obstructed from your main drug of choice, you'll want to go to another one, usually on the list of addictive drugs. You'll want to go there. Sometimes efforts will be made to get medical professionals to prescribe them for you. In fact, that's very, very common. But the superscripting strategy, I think, just helps us to understand that these have really different phenomenologies, and people who like these drugs will be able to tell you what the differences are. And so if you went down to, for example, opiate addicts, again, they'll have preferences for morphine, codeine, heroin, and they'll be able to tell you which drug they like the most of those, and they have slightly different molecular structure. Now, that's actually what you'd expect, right? Different molecules have different effects on their audiences. Now, there are presumably individual differences in the bodies of addicts that make them particularly like that molecule. There might actually be more complicated things like, can you function well or not well, you know, in your job, as it were, on this particular drug? And these all have absolutely different profiles in terms of whether they're in or out of your system. So alcohol usually is out of an alcoholic system when he wakes up in the morning. That has a different profile, therefore, for urges to use. Whereas if you get good long-acting benzodiazepines, they're never out of your system. And that sort of is nice. Well, it used to be nice. Anyway, this is just a general recommendation for how you do the phenomenological level. And what's good about it is it matches up with what we know about molecules. And it's an interesting thing to think about from an addict's point of view, that the addict loves a particular molecule. He doesn't know it under that description, and that's where the phenomenology completely fails us, okay? But I could show you the pictures of the molecules I like in what order I'd like them. So that's just a general lesson for here. Okay, ego depletion. So this is back to Mark's sort of psychological story. So if you use the natural method, it's good if a theory is, as it were, has evidence in its favor at all the different levels. Now, the good thing about the ego depletion story is it has support from the second law of thermodynamics. It's exactly what you'd expect, okay, from the second law of thermodynamics, that there'd be ego depletion. It also seems right, and I'll ask, maybe we can talk about this in this session. Mark, on the one hand, wants to suggest that so phenomenologically, it also seems to be the case that there's ego depletion. So we have the muscle, the lifting weights idea. Now, there's no doubt that Mark is right, that we could usually lift the weight more times than we do, but not forever. So on the one hand, he's on the side of his own view that this is not an infinite resource. Okay, there's a limit to how far a person can run without falling down into the puddle and so on. But this goes along with phenomenology. There's so much effort sometimes in resisting. And again, addicts really can talk about this. And I think that is a real difference between, for the example, I hate to encourage my colleague Walter or Senator Armstrong, but there's a real difference between the uncontrollable desire, which we do control, to go urinate, and the addict situation. Because the addict, imagine that not only do you have an uncontrollable desire to urinate, but that you're thinking 24/7 about urinating, even when you don't need to. That's very much a difference in the phenomenology that almost all addicts will tell you about. There's a mental obsession, even when you're not compelled to engage in the activity. And that seems like a difference in kind. All water is water, all water is H2O, but some water is ice, and there's a complete phase change at the point that water becomes ice. And I think there's a big difference between what most people understand as the ordinary problems that we face in self-control and the ones that addicts face mentally. In any case, the phenomenology supports this. We know from Mark's own evidence that the psychology supports these findings about the difficulties of self-control and so on and so forth. Now, I don't know. Neuroscience would support it because, of course, thermodynamics would tell us that they should find depletion in the parts of the brain. I don't know if there's been research done on that. Sometimes I notice when people say things like, there has been no research done on such and so, they just mean, I don't know any of it. And that's lots of stuff I don't know about. So I haven't looked into this. But this is a good thing about Mark's story. There's still the question, though, do we want to have, this relates to which level is the most important. One might worry that stories about ego depletion, self-control, etc., are still way too close to folk psychology, and we don't know the mechanisms by which the system is working. And that's last thing. There are techniques which are used in addictive among addicts and they're also used in non-Western traditions. So some people will know about techniques, certainly our clinicians will, in cognitive behavioral therapy or in mindfulness-based stress reduction theories. So one strategy to meet temptations that we've been talking about, and this is part of popular wisdom, would be your judgmental muscle, right? You sort of say, oh boy, I have a problem with eating too much cake, I have a problem with smoking, I have a problem with alcohol, and so you work to fight it. There are different ways to work to fight it. Like in Natalie's excellent talk this morning, I was talking to Walter about this afterwards, there was a suggestion that you might try to control your problem or you might try to make plans for today, or like right now, or you might try to make plans for over a big span of time. Addicts are often told, flex your judgmental muscle, but only for today, or only until noontime. Try not to use until noontime. And then see, once you get to noontime, then try to make it to dinner time. And then try to make it from dinner time to bed. This is very, very common. You hear these stories about one day at a time. The idea there is that that's supposed to be practically helpful. That if you think too far ahead of yourself, as it were, I mean, you really do want the outcome to be that you never use again. But the strategy is that you better think, it's really hard if you get too far ahead of yourself. There'll be something, there'll be a practical problem that you'll face, and maybe we'll have things to say about that. But the problem with meeting with the will, according to the things that Marx told us, is that it definitely can be effective short term, but either you're going to try to conserve, or in another case, you'll have expended so much energy, you'll tire and falter. Okay? So one technique that's commonly used, though, is this technique of non-judgmental observation. And this seems to be a therapeutic technique that I hear a lot on the streets is useful to people. So the idea just goes like this. In fact, someone in Amsterdam told me this recently. He said, I used to think, this is a world-class mathematician who also teaches mindfulness techniques, and he said, there are these old techniques in Shantideva, who's an 8th century Buddhist, that would say, if you have inappropriate lust towards someone, think of her as old and decrepit. Or think of her as decomposing. He said, this is not a good idea. This is a weird way to exercise self-control. But there are traditions which say things like that. And he says, I just think things like, if I'm on the train and I think that she would be lovely to have sex with, I think that would be lovely to have sex with, and I just let it go. So you don't fight yourself. Just allow. Think of all the crazy thoughts we all have. The idea is just let the thoughts come in, check it off that you had it, and just let it go. So the idea here is what's called non-judgmental observation. You just let the thoughts come through. And many addicts are taught this. Allow yourself. If you're an addict, you know how to use, and you know that there'll be cues in the world that will activate your desire to use all the time. And what you say to yourself is, I just had a normal thought for me, namely having that drink or using that drug. But just say, but I'm no longer the kind of person that does that. Check. And that's a way to actually keep the system from getting less exhausted, possibly. And maybe that could work. So thank you.